You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Set List, we'll hear from the Appleton band Tenement, whose latest album has earned national critical acclaim from Rolling Stone magazine to the New York Times. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Earlier this week, records revealed some of the state's wealthiest citizens, like Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley and Beloit billionaire Diane Hendricks, have had years-long stretches without paying state income taxes. Robert Mentzer is with us for the latest on this story and to round up some of the other top headlines from around Wisconsin. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Rob.
Well, let's start with the story on wealthy people in Wisconsin not paying for many years the state income tax. What are we seeing?
Sure. So we talked about this a couple of months ago when there were some leaked documents showing that the Beloit billionaire and Donald Trump campaign fundraiser, Diane Hendricks, didn't pay state income taxes for a period of years. And now it turns out it's not just Hendricks. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this week reported on several other super rich Wisconsinites who sometimes do not pay a dime in state income. That included a couple of members of the family that owns S.C. Johnson & Son, the company based in Racine that makes Windex and Raid and other household products, and also, as you mentioned, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley, not a billionaire, only a multimillionaire, who paid no state income tax from 2001 all the way through 2014.
And how far back does this go? How long a stretch are people going, apart from Chris Abley, without paying state income taxes?
So that's unusual. Most of these, this is like a whole, listen, the rich are not like you and me, Rob. This has been a whole course on how different rich people's taxes apparently are. There's all sorts of, like, there's tax credits and loopholes. There's maybe your business lost money that year, and so maybe you don't have business income, and that, I mean, that's one reason that you might not pay any income tax. The other thing that they do is they can hold over taxes sometimes for multiple years. So in the case of Diane Hendricks, also the S.C. Johnson, at least one of those people, it would be like for a couple of years they wouldn't pay. In general, the Journal Sentinel was mostly looking at 2013, 14, and 15 when they could get 15 numbers. But it's just sort of interesting to think somebody who has millions and millions and millions of dollars finds a way not to pay anything in state taxes.
The response is often the argument is they pay other kinds of taxes, maybe property taxes, or their businesses pay taxes, or they're paying people at these businesses who pay taxes, so they're not getting off scot-free.
Sure.
I guess is often the response.
Sure, if they buy a soda, they pay a sales tax as well. Yeah, and I mean it is worth saying. I mean, so one of the famous rich people that we often talk about in Wisconsin, John Menard, who owns Menards and is Wisconsin's richest man, he was found in this look. He did pay state income taxes in each of the last few years, and in 2013 he paid $35.7 million in state income taxes. That apparently is both because of the way his accounting is structured, that apparently is both his personal income taxes and his company's tax bills. But it does show that, I mean, yeah, you have a good year, you're going to pay a lot.
People on both sides of the aisle, have we seen a political response to this reporting so far?
I think that, it's certainly a bit of an embarrassment for Abley, who is a Democratic politician, and his camp said that a lot of the reason that his tax liability was wiped out was for charitable donations, and that definitely is part of the picture here. And so, in general, I think that the response is, we pay our fair share, and it's, what can you do? You try to move on. It's a little bit embarrassing, though.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at the top stories in Wisconsin this week. Well, Donald Trump going to be in Green Bay with his running mate, Mike Pence. What do we know about the event in Green Bay?
They're saying he's going to endorse Paul Ryan tonight. That's the scuttlebutt, at least the advance report. The Republican nominee for president has been having a very weird week and generated a lot of headlines and quite a response from within the Republican Party when he said that he was not quite there yet on endorsing House Speaker Paul Ryan for his primary, which is on Tuesday. So this caused a massive reaction. What the reports say is that in Green Bay tonight, Trump is going to endorse Ryan. We'll see. I mean, I'll believe it when I actually hear it, you know.
And some people won't be there to hear it, including Paul Ryan and some other prominent Wisconsin Republicans.
Yeah, almost none. Paul Ryan won't be there. Governor Scott Walker, who I think is... wins this whole ball game because he's going to be in Grandview, population 163, in the Northwoods for a spaghetti dinner, raising funds for the fire department there. I feel like that's the way to go. I was just going to say the other thing that's interesting is there. You know, Green Bay really is a key place in Wisconsin for this race. It's an interesting choice for Trump. This was going to be the site of a campaign stop by Hillary Clinton with President Barack Obama immediately after she won the nomination. That ended up being canceled following the Orlando shooting, but the campaign has said that it will be back there. And it's also the site of a very contested race for the House, the 8th Congressional District, where Representative Reed Ribble, who's a conservative Republican who also is vocally opposed to Donald Trump, he's retiring. He's not seeking re-election this year. And so there's a Republican primary coming on Tuesday. And so sort of the same type of intra-Republican war is playing out in that primary. And so it'll be interesting to see whether Trump has any opinions about that race. And Frank Lessay, who is a Trump supporter, is going to be there tonight. And I think the other Republicans are not.
That visit in Green Bay, the Democratic running mate in Milwaukee today. Do you expect we're going to get a lot of visits from the candidates?
We'll see, right? Some of the key states in the election that are supposed to be swing states are not looking all that that close right now. It was reported just I think this week that the Clinton campaign is taking spending out of Colorado, which is supposed to be very, very tight and isn't. There hasn't been a whole lot of polling in Wisconsin, so it's a bit hard to say how close or how far apart the candidates are right now. It definitely fits as part of it is a necessary state for a Trump strategy. A lot of what Trump's electoral strategy is based on the sort of upper Midwest Rust Belt, and Wisconsin is at least adjacent to that, and I think important for Trump to win.
And briefly, Rob, one more weird story out of Green Bay: weird clown sightings.
Yeah, you can't fully understand how creepy this clown is until you see the photograph of Gags the Clown, who made national and international news this week, because people are calling the police in Wisconsin or in Green Bay saying that this weird clown is walking around carrying four black balloons. The Green Bay Police Department reminded a reporter who called that it's not actually against the law to wear a clown costume and walk around, but it should be. Can we make a narrowly tailored First Amendment exception here? It's very creepy. Have you seen it?
I have seen the pictures. I have not seen the clown in person.
Not
gonna lie.
Yeah, I can't say I have either. But the pictures are very, very creepy. And maybe is it a viral marketing campaign for some horror movie?
Probably.
It something else? Who knows? But it's creepy.
It's at bar time, too. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. Yeah. Rob, thank you, as always, for joining us
All
this
right.
week.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joins us every Friday to round up the top news stories from around the state. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, courts have overturned voter ID laws in 5 states in the last 2 weeks. A political scientist tells us why we've seen so many rulings on election laws lately. First, we continue our summer music series set list. We invited artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances. They're airing every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend. Today, we feature the Appleton band Tenement, who recently stopped by the WPR studio to play some songs, and they talked to Veronica Rickard about how unlikely influences from Duke Ellington to Charles Ives fit into creating the wall of sound rock songs they're aiming for.
Thank you so much for coming into the studio and playing today.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, I read this great quote of yours about how you use guitar when you're putting together your tracks. And you said you put it in like a brick wall of sound, like the glue that holds everything together. Can you talk a little bit more about how you use guitar and what that philosophy is?
Well, I guess it's kind of like the Ramones, you know? When you listen to an old Ramones record, it's like just a wall of sound just slaps you across the face, and that's kind of what we've based our sound off almost completely. I think I'm kind of like a dictator when it comes to putting together our music, and I'm really obsessed with like rhythm. And so I think when I mix our records, I mix the guitars so high because I'm like obsessed with making sure the rhythm sounds exactly how it should. So the guitar has become this really loud, abrasive thing, you know. I just feel like there should be a almost danceable rhythm to every song, even if it's not like, you know, it doesn't sound like a club hit or something, but I mean, there should be like some distinct danceable rhythm to every song, whether it's like a heavy metal group or whatever.
Sense that eclectic is part of what you do, like you draw from a lot of different sources. I've read you reference Duke Ellington and that jazz improv kind of ethic, right? Too, do you use jazz as one of the templates that you draw from?
I don't know if I use jazz like consciously, but it's definitely something that has become a part of our music over time the more we educate ourselves about music. And I feel like that's just kind of what our lives are based around, is learning about music. I think like our songs are a little more structured, less as far as when we like put them together, they're not so much improvised. I think improvisation was something that became a part of our live routine for a long time. It still is from time to time, but I'm really more like interested in like structure and like composition and like things like that, you know. I got into jazz through people like Duke Ellington and Charles Mingus, who used improvisation a lot, but they also were very into like writing these big composed pieces. Now is the time to find your place in life. Don't join
for every girl and boy. Don't join. Well, I've read that you said that your band is a stubborn creative unit that does not conform to passing trends. Do you still feel that way about your band?
I think I do. I mean, we just kind of write the kind of music we want to write, and we've never, like, I don't feel like we've ever, like, been a part of a musical clique. And as a result, we've never really been, like, the hip band in the spotlight either. We've always just kind of been on a straight linear line, like, all along, you know.
Now, does that mean you have more freedom if you're not worried so much about, you know, whatever will sound poppy or will sell albums? Does it give you freedom to do what you want to do?
I think definitely, yeah. We aren't really concerned with, like, getting signed to a certain label or doing anything like that or pleasing certain people. So, naturally, I think we feel free to do whatever we want to do.
Is that hard to buck off, though, those expectations of the music industry? Usually the dream is this is the one thing you do, you get paid a lot of money, right? And you get to live your life the way you want making music, so
it's definitely a struggle sometimes, especially when you're kind of broke most of the time, like I am. You think about, like, what you could do to make money, but ultimately, I've at least up to this point in my life, I haven't been able to do what it takes to please people in order to get money. We just always do what we want to do. It's just the bottom line, I guess.
And you have been successful. You
tour.
Yeah,
to a degree, yeah.
Do you feel like that validates what you're doing? Like, you know, I can do what I want to do.
Yeah, I mean, we're not big money makers, but, you know, we've been successful to a degree.
also read that you first discovered punk, in particular, in high school. And it sounds like it was kind of this mind-blowing experience for you. Do you remember what it was like when you first cracked that door open?
Well, my brother bought me a Descendants CD. It was like Descendants Summary. It was the greatest hits of theirs, and I had never heard anything like it. And for a long time, you know, it took me a long time for my ears to get used to it. It was kind of like when I first heard jazz music. It was like, I don't understand this. Like, I can't enjoy it, much less understand it. But, you know, once your ears kind of got used to it, it became like a life-defining thing. You know, you subscribe to it and, like, just you based your life around punk, you know.
You based your life around
Pretty
punk.
Much. It became like a lifestyle in a way. You know, you kind of adapted the DIY punk lifestyle. I had a punk house for a long time. We would do shows, and we based Tenement around punk when we started. The whole idea of like doing like DIY tours and stuff was all because of bands like Black Flag and The Descendants and The Minutemen and bands like that. And so, you know, it definitely changed my life for sure, yeah.
And there is that strand in punk, which is like, this is not our world, we don't really belong here, you know, screw society, we're doing our own thing. And I heard some strands of that in one of your songs, Crop Circle Nation, the line, "We belong somewhere else."
Right.
Is that still part of it for you, that kind of outsider status?
I think that's why I'm interested in other kind of music at this point, like jazz and a lot of like classical and stuff like that, is because it takes me away from the world. Because I feel like the music I used to hear, I hear it everywhere now, and I'm just always searching for something that I, you know, I've never heard before. So,
what do you mean takes you away from the world?
Well, I mean, like, finding new music, it takes me away from the rest of the world, you know,
in a good way.
I can just kind of escape into it, you know.
So it's a good escape.
Oh yeah, definitely.
What is that like when you find that music and it becomes?
Well, it's euphoric.
It almost sounds like it's this whole separate world that you can go live in for a while.
Right.
Like, does it feel like that?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Listening to Charles Ives, I got this Charles Ives record recently, and it, I don't know, I've listened to it over and over again, and every time it takes me into a different world. I can just forget everything, you know.
What else have you been listening to like that? Charles Ives, you mentioned, what else?
Oh, man. That's a hard question. There's so much music out there. I don't know, I got this George Liberace record the other day. George Liberace goes Latin.
And wait, the piano player?
Right, yeah. And it's my first discovery of George Liberace, my first I was in this junk shop, and I saw the cover there, and I pulled the record out, and the record was on red wax, and I was just like, I just had this feeling. It was like a spiritual feeling, you know? It's just like, it's going to be important to me in some way. It's going to affect me in some way. So I bought it, you know? I don't know. It's like, maybe it will, maybe it won't. I don't know. George Liberace, whatever, but I find that, like, sometimes I'll discover these records, and it's, like, not necessarily even something that I'm usually interested in, but, like, it'll affect me down the road. I just get, like, this seriously spiritual feeling about records. It's, like, a very spiritual thing.
Really?
I don't know how to explain it.
No, you're doing a good job explaining it. I'm interested. So I also read Fiona Apple. Is that another one?
I love Fiona Apple, yes.
Is she, like, your Liberace experience?
I don't know, but I love her music. I don't know. I don't know.
Like, you've got all these influences coming in. You're talking about jazz, you're talking about Liberace.
Right.
By the way, first mention of Liberace on set list. And you might be writing a song, and you might hear something that you got inspired by from Liberace.
That's a lot of stuff on the last Tenement double LP that was, you know, inspired by things like Martin Denny's Exotica LP or Duke Ellington or whatever, you know.
And so going back to your origins now, as we start to wrap up, the Beatles. were really big for you when you first started, very first started getting into recording and playing music. How did that happen?
I was probably like 6 or 7 years old, and the Beatles anthologies were first coming out, like, what was that, like 1994, 1995 or something like that. And I'd go everywhere I'd go, the shopping malls, the record stores, everything. They would have these big life-size cutouts of the Beatles and stuff, and just, there was just something about it. It blew my mind, you know. I was watching these videos of the Beatles playing to thousands of people screaming, and it's like the classic romantic idea of the child getting into rock and roll, because it's just this alluring thing, you know. And I saw, like, that movie, That Thing You Do, you know, that was something I watched religiously when I was young, and I was like, I want to do that someday. And, it didn't quite turn out like that, but it turned out all right.
Well, I was remembering reading some biographies of the Beatles, and it had to be John and Paul. Yeah, Paul, who said that they just listened to the radio and they knew, we can do that.
Right.
That's our thing. They just kind of knew. Did you have that when you heard the Beatles? Did you think, I can do that?
Probably, yeah. And, you know, I started a band with a few of my cousins. We were like 6 or 7 years old, and we were just banging on pans, and like, they had like a guitar that they found in their attic and a little Casio keyboard, and like, we thought we were the Beatles, and we believed we could be.
So. And now not the Beatles, but you
guys. And now we're the Beatles.
You've got a successful career, though, touring.
Right, I guess, yeah.
So what's next for Tenement?
We're going to Finland, Sweden, Norway, and we're spending a few weeks there, and then we're coming home, and then we're doing a couple months around the U.S. and Canada. So that's it. That's in the immediate future. After that, I don't really know. We'll probably just keep making records and doing whatever, you know. It's just what we've always done, that linear, straight line, you know.
Amos, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was the Appleton band Tenement. You can catch them performing live August 12th at the Eau Claire Music Festival. Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to wpr.org/setlist. Coming up, voter ID laws have been hot-button issues nationwide. A political scientist tells us why we've seen so many court rulings on election laws this summer. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's The Political Junkie with Ken Rudin. On this week's edition, Ken and his guests look back on a rough week for the Donald Trump campaign. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, the debate over voter ID laws has raged on from Wisconsin to North Carolina and elsewhere this summer. Arguments have centered around whether the laws are a common-sense solution to voter fraud or whether they attack a rare crime at the expense of some eligible voters. Nearly 5 courts in 5 states have ruled against voter ID laws. That includes Wisconsin. Last week, a federal judge struck down parts of Wisconsin's voter ID law and other election rules related to early voting, time of residency in a voting ward, and absentee ballots. Joining me now to talk more about rulings on election laws around the country is Kimmy King. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back.
Good to be back. Support your public radio.
Thank you. Well, so many court rulings coming down, striking down all or part of various voter ID and other election changes lately. We can get into some of the details in a bit, Kimmy, but why this whole mess of rulings over this 2-week span?
Well, it's really a function of something that happened back in 2013 when the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 while Scalia was still alive and in the majority, that the formula used to determine when states fell under the federal jurisdiction of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, that they basically held that that formula was invalid, and it freed up the states to enact voting rights legislation, and enact they did. And that's why you are now seeing 2 to 3 years later, because it takes a while in federal court to get cases filed, it's really the onslaught of litigation finally reaching the courts.
And I've read that some people are looking at now a 4-4 U.S. Supreme Court and judges thinking, well, if I make this ruling, it's not going to be overruled, so now's the time to do it?
Yeah, well, I actually think that it's a function. If you go back to 2008, the Supreme Court had actually ruled on a voter identification law in Indiana. And so much of this comes down to what the government can show as its interests for why it's enacting any voting rights legislation, whether it has to do with voter ID or the hours of the polls or absentee ballots. And so, in essence, what this does is that they said that you have to look more closely at what the states are doing. States have to justify the interest that they are asserting. And now that Shelby County, the decision in 2013, came down, it's almost as if the courts are saying, well, if the Justice Department no longer has the ability to keep a close eye on what the states are doing, we, the federal courts, are going to be a guardian of that. And so it's arguable that that's what that is.
And looking at a lot of these rulings, a consistent theme is that, or the consistent question, I guess, is does this particular law unduly burden a particular group of people, whether that's a minority group, in some cases, is that Democratic voters? Does it affect one group's voting ability to vote more than another? Is that generally the main question?
In part of it, it is. But in the Marion County case in Indiana in 2008, what they said was that when they're looking at the state's law and any kind of burden on an individual voter or a political party or any group of people has to be justified by relevant and legitimate state interests sufficiently weighty to justify the limitation. So typically the state's interest is vote fraud. And so you have to prove that vote fraud is happening. But even if you prove vote fraud is happening, you have to show that the measure that you're putting in place is justified for that limitation. And so that's really what it boils down to, that the courts are looking extremely closely at the state's interest, and they're kind of holding them accountable if they're unable to show sufficient evidence. And that's what your judge said.
And one of the big questions there is the state's right to set their own laws versus federal rights. And as I understand it, that's been the argument from states a lot. We get to decide what the state interest is, not the federal government. And these federal court judges apparently not buying that lately.
In part, but understand our Constitution's founders, in their infinite wisdom, wanted a scheme where the states had a role in implementing elections. Over time, and with the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, indeed any of the amendments being passed on, extending the franchise or the right to vote to people, what has happened then, in essence, is that that right is a minimum floor that the federal government has the ability to protect. So while the states have the ability to regulate elections, the federal government has the ability to set the federal floor on the minimum rights that are guaranteed. And what you are seeing here is the clash between what the floor says and what the states can be allowed to do.
We're talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at a string of rulings. Multiple states, federal judges are overturning all or parts of recently changed election laws, often involving voter ID, but not exclusively. Kimmy, let's focus in on voter ID in particular. That's the one where the idea of fraud comes up and fraud prevention. What's been the trend in those laws being passed, and now what judges are saying over the last 2 weeks?
Well, it's really almost dizzying to keep track of it, because states had begun enacting voter legislation, you know, voter identification laws going back to 2000. I mean, this is not something that is new, really. But what is new is the kind of detailed regulations that can be applied. And so, for example, one of the things that got the Texas voter ID into trouble with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is hardly a liberal court, it's actually considered to be one of the most conservative in the country, what they were unhappy about was, well, why is it you're allowing military IDs and concealed handgun carry permits, but you don't allow IDs from state employees or university photo identification? And so it's that if you say you want to protect voting rights, well, then you have to make sure that you are actually doing that with the mechanism that you've put in place.
Voter ID isn't the only thing that's been involved in some of these rulings, including here in Wisconsin, changes to early voting laws, restrictions on early voting compared to what had come before. That I think there's an Ohio ruling on that recently as well. Can you talk about how that has been seen as affecting different groups differently and running afoul of the courts?
Well, it can vary substantially, and this is another thing that the states have to show as evidentiary proofs when they go into court. And so your judge struck down, for example, a ban on emailing absentee ballots to voters, right? And if you look, for example, at North Dakota, you know, said that voters don't have to register, but they put in place identity cards. Well, for the Native American population, about 25% of them who are otherwise eligible to vote don't have that ID. But if you look at the non-American Indian population, only 12%. So the North Dakota judge looked at that and said, that has an impact on a specific group. So another challenge you will see with voter identification that you're starting to see will be women who have changed their name if they got married or if they got divorced. Men who want to hyphenate their name with their wife. And so understand that it really depends on the litigation. And what happens in each of the cases is that all the groups come forward and they show how this law in this state is problematic. And so once again, it's almost like the same-sex marriage, you know, issue in marriage equality. We have this patchwork of laws because the states can regulate elections, but they can't interfere with voting rights. And that's what judges are struggling with.
We're talking to Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, looking at the rise in rulings lately on election laws. And this is just a few months ahead of the general election. We'll get to that in just a minute. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you think about the recent rulings, actually two different rulings from federal judges related to election laws in Wisconsin, one limited to photo ID, one covering some other ground? Do you think there should be changes to election laws this close to the general election in November? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, looking at multiple states around the country, including Wisconsin, where rulings came down on election laws over the last couple of weeks. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are the changes in voter ID laws, other election laws, early voting, things like that, are they impacting you? Do you help people register to vote, trying to get more people in your community to the polls? Do you think that voter ID laws should be struck down now, close to the November election? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kimmy, let's look at that question. These courts are ruling on voter ID laws, other election laws, with elections, as we keep hearing, 90-some days away now in the presidential election.
So part of the reason why everyone is interested, and it will be very curious to see how this plays out, but if you were tracking public opinion polls in the first 2 days following the conclusion of the Democratic Convention, you saw the poll numbers between Trump and Clinton roughly proximate to where they were at this point in the 2000 election. So what I'd like your listeners to think about as we move forward is that if those poll numbers continue to track the way they did, then we could be set for another showdown where you would have a divide regarding the vote being so close that it could, and if you have a third party get in because they're unhappy about Donald Trump, it may divide the vote because you have to have that majority vote in the Electoral College, and that's when it gets messy. That's when we face another, you know, constitutional potential crisis where it would be thrown to the House of Representatives and to the Senate. I think at this point it's really unlikely the Supreme Court will weigh in again, because in the Bush and Gore debacle of 2000, they really came away wounded and their legitimacy suffered greatly.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Troy is on the line in Milwaukee. Troy, hi.
Hello. I would just make a challenge out there. I've been talking to a lot of people about this, and one of the things I notice is really obvious is when you have a conversation with somebody about this and you get over the statistic that this is a minority, the voter fraud is not really even a major issue, then you get into these conversations and you'll find out that when you unpeel that onion, these are about just some sort of prejudice or discrimination where a person feels that a certain person or a minority or a social class shouldn't be allowed to vote. When you get into those conversations.
Troy, thanks for the call. And Kimmy, one of the rulings, I think it might have been the North Carolina one, the judge said this really specifically, the judge thought these laws were targeting minority groups. That was the outcome. That's why the judge ruled that way. What do you make of that?
Actually, the North Carolina, the Fourth Circuit, was a little brutal on the North Carolina law, which included a bunch of voting restrictions, but it also shortened the early voting period. It banned same-day registration. And so the Fourth Circuit found that when they looked back at the data and demographics, they said that it actually targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision, and that it imposes cures for problems that did not exist. Those are damning words about a state law. There, they're clearly finding intent, that you intended to discriminate. The Fifth Circuit, again, more conservative, didn't come out and sort of go that far, but it looked at this discriminatory impact and said, you better come up with a fix before the elections in November. So they gave them their marching orders. So while they may have said it was just an impact, they also said it's an impact you got to do something about.
Troy, thanks for that call. And yeah, I wonder how much does that matter to a court if there was an intent, a provable intent on the legislature's part to disenfranchise a minority group, which seems like it'd be really hard to prove. Nobody's going to say in a press release that's what we're trying to do, versus the outcome, which it doesn't matter what the intent was.
So every court, and this is part of the reason why this is going to ultimately land for further ruling in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, whether it's a 4-4 court or it's after the election and we have somebody else in, it really boils down to, in the post-Shelby case, in the post-2013 era, when the federal government does not have the same role as it did before, at least in terms of the office of the executive, the presidency, what role will the courts have? And what this signals to us is, so far, the courts are saying, yeah, we will take that up. If the federal government isn't going to do what it should, if the Supreme Court doesn't have the full complement of people that it needs, we are going to continue making determinations about this.
If I can step back to kind of a civics 101 level, Kimmy, is this often how things work? Something changes at the federal level, and in this case, that change in the Voting Rights Act. Then things change at the state level. States try lots of new things, see what flies, what doesn't, and then it percolates back up to that Supreme Court ruling in the future.
This is such a great question. You really should have been a poli-sci major, because we look at this issue of what we call policy diffusion. And you look at the extent to which policies move across these United States and the extent to which there is pushback when policies are implemented. And I don't care if you're looking at transgender bathrooms, if you're looking at voting rights, whatever issue, gender discrimination, there in any kind of social movement, there's always a push to change and then a push back. Whether it's conservative or liberal change makes no difference. It's that the change occurs. And so what you're seeing now, you know, it's interesting because Kansas also had a law, and to try to avoid some of that federal-state stuff, they tried to draw distinctions between being able to vote in federal elections and the ID you had to have there, and then the kind of ID you had to have in state elections. But keep in mind, and then the attorney, the courts dispatched with that. The state attorney general tried one last move, and this last go-round and this last set of rulings in the last 2 weeks, Kansas judge said, that's not going to fly either, state attorney general.
All right, Kimmy, we'll leave it there. Thanks. It's always good to talk to you.
You bet.
We've been talking to Kimmy King. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. We've been looking at all of these court rulings in Wisconsin and a handful of other states overturning part or all of voter ID laws and other recently passed election laws around the country. The divide between moderate and progressive Democrats is showing up in a state Senate primary in Milwaukee County. In the 4th District, incumbent Lena Taylor is trying to fend off a challenge from State Representative Mandela Barnes. Chuck Quirnbach reports.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being here.
State Senator Taylor worked the crowd at a national night out event in Milwaukee's Lincoln Park this week. She was there with a small group of volunteers seeking votes in next Tuesday's primary election. The 13-year lawmaker says she remains very connected to her district.
This isn't something I do sometime. We've been doing this event for years, but this is the kind of work that we do every day. We had like 75,000 contacts in our office since I've been a legislator.
Taylor says she's fought hard for her constituents, be it on criminal justice issues or joining the other Democratic senators who briefly left the state in 2011 to slow down Governor Scott Walker's effort to curtail collective bargaining for public sector workers. But the senator's critics say she's too far to the center on some topics, like payday lending.
If we don't get it, shut it down! If we don't get it, shut it down!
About 100 members of Wisconsin Citizen Action demonstrated inside a check-cashing outlet in Milwaukee this week to support stronger federal regulation of the payday loan industry. A few minutes later, outside the building, Taylor's Democratic primary opponent, Mandela Barnes, spoke to the crowd, saying a cap is needed on the interest rates the short-term lenders charge. Representative Barnes, elected in 2012, says Taylor blocked a cap during the state's attempt to regulate payday lenders.
You know, she talks about the fact that she introduced payday loan reform, but she voted against capping the interest rate. I mean, that's something she can't run from. She's trying to, as she should, but it's fact.
Taylor says the charge is only partly true and doesn't reflect her wish to get a bill passed.
It's disingenuous to say to people, oh, she didn't vote for a cap. I actually authored a lower cap myself before, but did vote for the cap not to exist so that we could at least get something done.
Taylor and Barnes also differ on a few other topics, notably education and guns. Barnes says the senator was wrong to vote for the concealed carry of firearms and the so-called Castle Doctrine, allowing more people to use deadly force in self-defense.
This race is about public safety. It's about making our community safer. It's about combating the scourge of gun violence and realizing that more guns aren't the answer to combating gun crimes.
Barnes also says Taylor has done too much to help private voucher schools. So the representative is claiming the progressive label in the 4th District Senate race.
If you consider standing strong for public education, working to get guns off the streets and providing economic opportunity to people, then that would make me the more progressive candidate.
But Taylor isn't ready to give up the left end of the spectrum. She says she's been a champion of corrections reform to help current and former inmates.
And how justice reinvestment has led to work that we're doing on two committees right now. One where we received a technical assistance grant, and the other where we literally are doing the work to move the barriers for people to reenter.
This week, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abele, a Democrat who says he works with Republicans to get things done, endorsed Lena Taylor. Mandela Barnes is highlighting backing from the Milwaukee County Bus Drivers Union, the American Federation of Teachers, and the immigrants' rights group Voces de la Frontera. There's no Republican running in the 4th District Senate race, so Tuesday's Democratic primary between the longtime lawmaker and her younger challenger will likely settle the contest. Chuck Quirnbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.